I kept thinking about, and y'all may have figured this out by now, I opened this up, class up last time, by saying that Hebrews is a simple book in some ways. In some ways, it's a complex book. By the time we get through lesson two, we will have pretty much been through the whole book of Hebrews, in case you haven't noticed, as you do your marking. And so I thought maybe after the second class we could just disband. But once we do that, we'll get more into the trees, I suppose, if you do the forest and tree metaphor. Not like other letters in which the addressees are identified specifically, at least in the letters to the various epistles to the various churches. This letter we talked about last class gives its name legitimately as being to the Hebrews. That said, I thought it was appropriate to go through and say, well, you know, who is this audience that this writer is sending this to, and do that from what's in the text, and see what we can conclude. And one of the things, obviously, we'll conclude about it, I think, from what you read, is these were Hebrews. But there are a number of other aspects of the audience to whom he's writing that come out in the text. And so, as we go through this, and this is one of those sections, we'll just go through the questions. They're pretty self-explanatory. I think they'll add to our understanding of who the audience was. What do y'all conclude, or what do the various verses we put in give you in the way of insight to these folks that this writer is writing to, starting with Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and verse 23 and 19? I have to do this in most classes. To explain to you that I ask the question and get the answers.
Jewish converts.
And they knew the writer.
They were familiar with the Old Testament.
Okay, that's true. What did you get out of Hebrews 13 specifically? What did we get out of Hebrews 13?
They knew Timothy
and they knew the writer.
Okay.
And the writer was hoping to come to them soon.
All right, and he had been with them in the past, hadn't he? Mm-hmm. So this was not... Saved your seat. Your husband saved your seat, I think. Somewhere. Okay, the other things we mentioned are true. We'll get to the verses, I think, as we go through this. Hebrews 3. So, and we talked a little bit about this, I think. I'll get confused on what we talked about together and what I talked to individuals about. But that this writer knew these folks and evidently had been with them in some fashion in the past, that he was looking to be restored to them, as he says in the 13th chapter. How about Hebrews 10b, Hebrews 10, 32, 34?
They had experienced suffering and tribulations, the property had been seized,
Okay, so he knows their. There's indication he knows their history, and that history, as Linda says, is a history where they've been suffering. And really, he calls on them. There's one specific thing he calls on them to do. The way he puts this, look in Hebrews 10:32.
32.
Yeah, look, keep me honest. My voice is rattling.
I'm hard of hearing, too.
Yeah. 10:32, but remember your former days when after being enlightened you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by me being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession. So he's, there are a number of things in here. One, they endured some pretty harsh things. And he's going to call upon them to remember that. And we're jumping ahead, but What is this letter? What was his intent in this letter? It's one of your questions. Why did he write this letter?
He wrote it to exhort them to be steadfast in this, the persecutions.
Right. So exhorting them. That's what he's doing here. He's exhorting them. Remember their former days. There's another thing in 12:4. They'd suffer, but what does it say in 12:4?
They haven't resisted to the point of suffering.
Okay, so they've been undergoing persecution, but not to the extent that their group had this is a bring your own.
There's one more.
BYOC. Bring your own chair. Somewhere. Right here. Here you are, right here, Ron.
I don't want a front row.
Show some leadership.
I don't want a front row.
He's going to lead the ones in the back. Yeah.
Okay, so they did not suffer to the extent of death yet. Okay, Hebrews 6:10 and 10:34 for that matter. What do you see about these people? Okay, so they had exhibited the second greatest law, hadn't they? Plus the fact that they were ministering to those of their number who were in prison. Okay? Hebrews 5:11, 2:1, 10:25, that set of verses. Okay, so they're not... You know, in spite of the fact he commends them throughout in several places, there is a problem, isn't it? Really, in part, the heart of this book is to address the problem, the risk that existed, the risk that they may fall away, the fact that he recognizes the fact that they're babes and they ought to be teachers. So they weren't growing like they should have been growing. And as a result of that, as well, risk falling away. Hebrews 2:3. 2:3 and 4.
It says that they were partakers and believers in the message, you know, of salvation spoken by first the Lord, then the apostles and prophets, and confirmed by the Holy Spirit.
Okay,
so they had heard the word and believed it.
And calls them partakers of Christ. What's mm-hmm. our word for that?
Christian.
So they're Christians. And so, you know, we talked about them being Hebrews. These were Hebrew Christians. Okay, Hebrews 13:7, 5:12. I just mentioned the should have been teachers, and in fact, that those verses say one other thing about them. Why should they be teachers?
That's not they ought to be teachers.
By this time, they ought to be. By this time, in the case that they've been around, yeah, you know, they hadn't been. They're not novices in the faith in the sense that they, in terms of time. They were novices in some other ways, but not in terms of time. Hebrews 4, 6, 4 through 8, 10, 36 through 39. I mentioned this a moment ago, too. Just another set of verses. Back it up.
Some were falling away.
Mm-hmm. Okay, falling away. They were either some had, and in addition, you see throughout the book, not just here, that there was a risk that they would fall away as well. So the risk of apostasy among these people. The other is, just in your own words, what else do you get out of chapter 1 through 10 in particular? Just kind of summarize question. Yes, it is.
Well, to me, you know, he goes back and rehearses the law, the old law, and what the Jews had under the law, And so they had heard this, they had believed that by becoming partakers of Christ, they had put that behind them. And, of course, there was always the possibility of the Judaizing teachers, you know, trying to influence them again to go back into partake of some of the law, you know. They wanted to mix it, you know, and circumcised in order to be saved for the Gentiles. But, you know, to put away the law and to go to the new and better things.
Okay. Somebody else?
They had a Jewish background, quite extensive. I mean, it talks about the Jews spoke to their fathers, okay, their forefathers. So they were very knowledgeable about the Jewish law and the tabernacle and the sacrifices. And
lots of Old Testament.
Lots of Old Testament.
Lots of Old Testament, yeah.
You read anything about circumcision? You read anything about abstinence from things sacrificed to idols?
No.
You read anything about matters that would pertain to Gentiles? In fact, you even find the word Gentile in the book in any way, shape, or form. There's some things that are absent as well. That also, they're just, these are indicators that, you know, these people were Jews. They understood. He wasn't trying to deal with Gentiles. He wasn't dealing with issues between Gentiles and Jews, but rather he was dealing with issues, or he was using it in his argumentation at least, things that were very familiar to people who were Jews.
It seemed like he was trying to keep it from going back into Judaism. A lot of them seemed like they were.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Contemplating doing that.
That's true. I think that's true. And, you know, his arguments are all of his arguments, you know, rephrase that. He's arguing to show superiority of Christ and what, and all the things that come along with that, as opposed to the things that were in the Old Covenant. And, of course, the book's just full of things out of the Old Covenant in terms of how things were under that system. Okay, so this is these are the people. They've got some strengths, like people everywhere. They've got some strengths, some very good, some commendation, some concerns. And so the writer is trying to encourage them, exhort them to remain faithful. And we'll see that as we study the book in detail. Okay, we hit authenticity last time.
Well,
yes.
You have external evidence. And the point there, they have any points underneath
there. External evidence on pertaining to this, that is, who is this written to? All of the manuscripts that you'll find Hebrews in, it's titled to the Hebrews. So Hebrews is the title, and the title is associated with it. So that, you know, it was seen as being written to Hebrew Christians in terms of that source.
I want to comment. You know, in Acts 6, there's two groups of Jewish brethren that are addressed in Acts 6. One is called the Hebrews, the other one, the Hellenistic Jews. And I'm wondering, these Hebrews, if external evidence suggested that, I thought they were ones who kept the Hebrew language and that kept the Hebrew custom, versus other Jews who maybe were more picking up more of the Greek culture and Greek language. And I don't know what your studies showed, if that was if the word Hebrew, what is that, how that different?
Well, first of all, the letter written here, when I say Hebrews, anytime you find Hebrew, it's only what men have put on it, right? The author didn't call them Hebrews, and so that's a choice that men have made based on content. And my answer to that part of it would be content. When you look at the content, it really isn't speaking to so much whether these were Hellenistic Jews or, you know, or Jews that had taken up the culture of the Greeks, or whether these were dyed-in-the-wool Hebrews in the sense of by blood, by birth. it makes no distinction to that, and I didn't find anything in my studies to draw that out particularly. I mean, you'll see comments of speculation, but that's about it. At least that's all I found. I don't know if you had anything to add to that. Okay, data writing. This is as good, you know, we had the, how come y'all let it get so hot?
It feels good.
Oh.
No, it doesn't.
Just walk outside, if you're hot.
Yeah, see? Maybe this will slide up here at the time.
Yeah,
it was so clear we went through about who the author was of this book. I figured y'all wouldn't have any trouble with the time. The dating of the book. When was the book written?
Well, a question about author, and I'm not going to off into author. Is this the only book of the Bible that we don't know the author?
I don't know the author of Job.
Okay, is this other than Job? Is this, I mean, there are very few books that are in that category, right? Very, very
Joshua.
Well, you know, there are books that I don't know the. There are other books, and I have to sit down and go through them.
I haven't done that either.
But yes, there are.
Most of all, Paul's books are. He sides off by Paul. Yeah. You know it's Paul.
Yeah. Of course, you know the Gospels, and you know Luke. But there are old times. I just haven't, you know, that one came to mind immediately. And I'd have to go through on the prophets. Some of the prophets. Mm-hmm. They're the words, and it's clear who they're writing about. It's not necessarily clear who's doing the writing.
The writing itself.
Okay. That's all the digression on that one I'm all out. Date.
Most probably.
Did y'all come up with? I gave y'all some things to look at. Now, let me come back to that in just a second. Let me just talk for a minute about where this is written from. Again, some epistles. You know where they're written from. You put that story together. Here, you can only... it's a little stronger than a guess about where it's not written from, but not necessarily be able to identify where it is written from. They really ran out... When I say there's only two places that have been mentioned, one is... two is what I meant to say. One is that these were Christians in Jerusalem. The other was they were in Rome. And the reason Rome is because Clement of Rome had a lot of quotations in an early letter that he wrote, so people wanted to associate Rome, but there's no evidence beyond that. Why would you say it is not Jerusalem where they're located? Maybe you wouldn't say that. Why would I say it's probably not Jerusalem? 12:4. Remember 12:4. These Christians have been, first of all, these Christians have been persecuted, had they not? So that sort of sets the date sometime after the stoning of Stephen and those sets of events. But what hadn't happened? Well, hang on that thought, because nowhere in this book do I think you find the word temple ever written down. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong.
But this is.
So you don't know if temple was or wasn't necessarily. I agree with you, but that's not. We'll get to that.
But the Levitical priesthood was not still going on. It had been put away. The covenant had been there.
Let me come back to that. 12. I gave you an answer. 12:4. What's 12:4 say?
Setting of blood.
Sorry?
The setting of blood.
Okay. Whose blood? Theirs. They had not died for their faith, had they? Obviously, the people he's writing to hadn't died, but the Bible's writing to them, but the people that were associated with him hadn't died.
So your point is,
what's that tell you about, what do you know about Christians in Jerusalem?
They were being put to death.
They were put to death. I mean, Stephen. Jewish Christians dispersed in Acts 8 because of the persecution. People, Christians were being killed. They went everywhere. So the likelihood of this Jerusalem, is, in my opinion, is low. But I can't prove it one way or the other. Yeah.
But couldn't you take that exactly the flip side and say, this is, and I'm not arguing it's Jerusalem, but it is Jerusalem, and it just hasn't occurred yet? It's just
that. Well, here's the other side of that. When he makes a comment in chapter 2, verse 3, about who they got the message from, who they get it from. Did they get it from Jesus? Would you expect them to get it from Jesus? If they lived there prior to the persecution, would you expect someone would have heard Jesus? See, the timing and the location, that doesn't necessarily prove anything either. You just put all these facts together and, you know. But I don't want to spend more time speculating. I'm just saying, if there's a case to be made for not being Jerusalem, that's one I would make. But just be aware. It really doesn't matter. Get right down to it. The message is what matters, not where they were.
After Christ's death.
Yeah, it was after Christ's death. Somebody wanted to bring up the tabernacle, temple, whatever. I gave you some verses, and if you like my wife, you'll have absolutely no idea why I wrote these down and what I was asking. So I'll try to make it semi-clear. I gave you four verses. Hebrews 7:8, 9:6-10, 13, and 8:13. And let's just go real quick to those. Look at Hebrews 7. Actually, I want to look at Hebrews 7:5 for a moment. 7:5. Here he's talking about, gotten into this discussion about Melchizedek. He says, those indeed are the sons of Levi who received the priest's office have commandment in the law to collect a tenth of the people. Okay, who received the priest's office, but the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who promises without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In this case, mortal man receives tithes, but in that case, one receives them of whom he is witness that he lives on. The only thing I want to call your attention for a moment is, and it's New American Standard, I think that King James and New King James may use past tense verbs. Just notice it's present tense for a moment. Look at 9:6. Now here he's talking about the tabernacle, okay? And things in it. And he says, now when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. But in the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food, drink, etc. Notice again, what's the tense of that? What are the tenses of the verbs? Present tense. Now, that'll be the next verse, even. Christ has died. He's writing to a bunch of Christians. Does the tabernacle still exist? Come on, no. Tabernacle doesn't exist. Tabernacle is long gone. The temple exists, not the tabernacle. Not the one he's talking about. And you can get that very, you know, that also within the text will tell you
the way the holy place has not been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing. Is the way into the holy place is the way into the The way into the holy place has not been disclosed. Has it been disclosed? What holy place is in view here? What Christ is. That's the holy place that's in view. So look, the only thing I want to draw your attention to, these are present tense, but some of these things aren't present. But, having said that, if that doesn't confuse you enough, there's a figure, I guess you call it a figure of speech, that I think we're somewhat familiar with. That's where, so call it a historical present. Historical present. And it's where you talk about past things and to provide the vivid description, you use present tense verbs. And that's what's going on here. Now, you say, well, what in the world does that have to do with time? Why in the world would the writer write about these things as if they existed, if they had no bearing to these people at this time, to what was going on? While the tabernacle, the tent traveled around, may not exist, what does exist is the temple. What it suggests is the temple worship still exists. These things are still going on in the temple, in the Holy of Holies in the temple. And so the temple is still standing. Jerusalem temple is still standing. The other thing, the other strong indicator is, you don't find anywhere, do you find anywhere in this book, the writer talking about how the temple and how all of that, you know, how the Jews have destroyed, the Romans have destroyed Jerusalem and the temple is gone. But this book would be about a page long had the temple been destroyed. Wouldn't be any point arguing all this stuff if the temple been destroyed. Okay? Now, there's an indication over, and we'll get to this when we talk about chapter 10. There's an indication in chapter 10, 25. Because not you want to take, when we talk about the day approaching, if that is the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay? So, that's what this was all about. And, you know, the date could vary. It's sometime before, I think, before A.D. 70 when the destruction of Jerusalem came along. Most likely after the persecution that went on in Jerusalem and they scattered. Because people were being killed for their faith. And so you find the timing of this probably, take your pick, 1665, 65 A.D., something like that. Okay?
Everything that we've read from the 6th to, mine's all past tense.
New King James? Yeah, New King James. And King James, I mean, by that, the way their text is past tense. And it's just a question of the text that's being used, the original text. There's more manuscripts available for New American Standard Language Version. But even so, if past would work out just fine, it makes it a lot easier.
This
I studied the first time on New King James. I was studying with New King James the first time I studied this, and it made it a lot easier to explain it.
This audience understands that Jesus died for their sins, and there's no longer a need for those sacrifices in the way that they used to do. Although,
do they understand it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, if they're Christians, they should. But that's part of his argument. They're wanting to fall back. You know, it seems they're wanting to go back into the old ways.
Right.
But now there's no reason for them to believe.
Because another reason why they might talk about the temple and all that is because Jesus is the high priest now, not the tribe and the people that were assigned the holy place. And you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Well, his argument is going to, as we read through the book, that's going to be his argument is going to be, yes, Jesus is our high priest now, and these things are, they're obsolete, they're gone. Yeah, Pat.
If this was before the destruction of the temple, these people still bought their tithes. They, as Paul went and offered a vow, completed a vow, which was something, this was both civil and religious at one point. And then after Christ died, these people had to, in their mind, make that separation, because God did still provide for the priests until the temple was destroyed, if I understand or misunderstand, whichever, because Paul would not have done something. He would not have gone and fulfilled the vow in the temple if that would have been contradictory to what the teaching of Christ was and what he was teaching them. He wouldn't do something he was teaching them not to do.
I will caveat this a bit. Yeah, he wouldn't. However, I think the vow he made, there are two things going on. Same reason he circumcised some and not circumcised others. Circumcision meant nothing. The vow meant something, right? But the paraphernalia around it meant nothing. And so, yeah, did God continue to provide for the priest and call for providing for the priest? I wouldn't conclude that.
Well, if it was still a civil law, if there was nothing they had to do and yet it was still their civil law, and the only taxes they paid, or if we would call it taxes, was the tithe they paid to the priest for their support, their sacrifices and those kind of, I'm not saying they did the sacrifices, but was there none of the law that they, how did God provide for the priest, and why does it
after
say
Christ, I don't think he did.
Then how was it civil? What civilly did they have to do? They weren't to practice circumcision anymore. And if they weren't to tithe for the priest to still support them until the temple was destroyed. What did they do? What was it? How was this still their civil law? What?
I don't know that I can answer your question. I mean, that's just something I don't know, because it's not provided. I can't read it. I'll grant there's a transition that went on. I don't know to what extent God allowed certain things and God called for certain things.
Just a question. I'd love
to answer. I mean, clearly the Roman government had authority. So these people were under the Roman government and they were to adhere to the Roman government, right? And they were to pay taxes to the Roman government and all that. And so we talk about...
Even when they were still under the Jewish law.
But you look at when Paul was in court, he didn't, after Christ, he did not answer to the Sanhedrin. But he didn't answer to them. He answered the Romans. He went and made his plea before the Romans. So even that's not clear to me. Anyway, what time's the bell ring?
5 minutes.
Quarter till, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to get a lesson too. Can I get a lesson too?
There has to be some transition in the way, though, because that's the way for us to do. Something is becoming obsolete, which means it's been started.
Well, here we did to it, but look at your old... Look.
I know, I just looked at the rules a minute ago, but...
Look at the smaller cases when you start to say, okay, where did that statement get made? And therefore, why is that conclusion made? So just bear that in mind. When these Old Testament scriptures are made, go back and think about what is the point of the Old Testament scripture? What's it saying? And there's, because most of them, I mean, they all, I guess, apply to these people.
If Christ died and shed his blood, the Old Testament is obsolete.
It took it away, it was cross, took it away. No two ways about that. It's black and white.
Right.
Okay. Now can I go too?
Yeah,
all right.
That's your class.
Okay, I asked you to go through and mark better. And I hope you to do what I asked in this sense. What's being modified? You know, what word is it occur and what is being better? What is better in all this? And we're just going to run through this. So I'm going to stand up here and you're going to tell me, give me a verse, give me what's better.
For Christ is better than the angels.
Okay. Christ is better than the angels. I got more than one. Somebody tell me another one.
6:9.
Okay, 6:9 what?
We are convinced that those things concern you that chose and fallen away.
Right, no apostasy. No way. The way I wrote that.
722 is a better covenant.
722, better covenant, right.
719, a better hope.
Right.
Better hope?
Yes.
Keep going.
8:6, better covenant, and acted on better promises.
There's a 2 in that one. Mm-hmm. Did I get 7:7? The lesser is blessed by the better.
Better.
Mine says better, greater.
Okay, greater,
yeah.
Better.
You see, I marked greater, more, you know, in that.
New American Standard is greater, I think, probably, and the New King James is better. Okay. And it has to do with priesthood. All right. Give me another one.
9:11.
10:34.
Okay, better in enduring possession, huh? Linda, you said something?
I put 9:11 and 9:14.
Okay,
in that kind of thing. You know, that's greater tabernacle.
Okay.
You know, those kind of things. Better sacrifices, 9:23.
10:1.
9:23, better sacrifices. I'm sorry, 10 what?
10:1 says the law is only a shadow of the good things that are coming, not a reality itself, not reality itself.
Okay,
the
by implication, good. By implication, it's better than that.
Right.
Okay. About 11:16.
Better country.
Mm-hmm. Better country. How about 11:35?
Better
direction. How many of y'all have these? What about 11:11?
11:40.
What about 11:40?
Better promise.
God is the lesson, better for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'll talk about what that's all about when we get there. Hebrews 12:24.
Better than
blood of anyone over sacrifice. Okay. Christ sacrifice versus Abel. Okay.
Well, there's also free trade.
Okay. You did,
yes.
Yeah.
No glory and honor.
Yeah.
Right. 3:3 and 9:14 both. I've got those in my notes. I didn't have those. One of them is really more glory. 3:3 is more glory than Moses and more honor than his house. I didn't ask you to look up just more by itself, but that shows up there. More does show up a lot of times with estimate, why I asked the way I did. What do you get 1:4?
Works his name.
You know, estimate name. What's another one?
8:6.
And it is?
The ministry.
Okay, ministry. Keep going.
11:4 more, so practice.
Okay. See, when we talk about, let me just make a statement here. When we talk about perfect, perfect means different things in the Bible depending on context. It can mean that it's complete or finished. I don't know that perfect ever means sin
perfect.
Yeah, we think of it sometimes as perfect. But it also can mean fulfillment, accomplishment. It means that it's used to associate it with the high state of the thing under consideration. I think we'll see it used that way a lot in Hebrews. Okay? So, just that, we'll deal with that more if we get to specifics later. But what did you find? I found about 13 different references for perfect or perfected. What did y'all find? Click them off.
2:10.
Okay.
Author, you know, of their salvation.
Yeah. Captain of their salvation, perfected. through suffering. So, and this is an interesting one, dealing with Christ and his suffering and death and the glory that he received. Okay?
Having been made more perfect by my suffering.
Okay, so it had to do with his obedience. Okay, what else? His suffering and obedience.
7:19, law made nothing perfect.
What was that?
The law made nothing perfect. 7:19.
Mm-hmm. I put down 7:11 to pure the perfection, not to the law of Moses.
Yes,
yeah,
not. That's a not yeah. case.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one in 6:1. What is it? 6:1?
Go on to perfection.
Let us go on to perfection. Let me do it, maturity in Christ. Priesthood. Oops, answer my question. So Hebrews 7:28, dealing with the priesthood. What's another one? What's the next one? Okay, Hebrews 9:9. Okay.
9:11. Perfect tabernacle.
Okay, the tabernacle. Okay, having to do with the priest, correct?
Mm-hmm.
10:14. 10:14 having to do with
perfected offerings.
Who?
Perfected those who are sanctified.
Saints. Okay.
Well, when there's a change in the priesthood, there's much likely to be a change in the law.
Correct?
7:11.
11:40.
Okay, please, that the they shall not be made perfect apart from us. That is the pre new covenant faithful. Dealing with Hebrews 12:23. Spirits of just men in Hebrews 13:21. You may not have gotten that one. Make you complete. Complete is another. Shows up perfect up there in King James Version. Hebrews 13:21.
Twelve two.
What 12:2? What?
Christ the author of perfecting our faith.
No, I just right over there, and I know why.
What was
13:21? 13:21 makes you complete in every good work, every good deed, work to do as well. It's the New King James Version. I'm sorry, it's King James Version. I'm going to say it again.
12:2.
It's the New King James, I believe.
So what would it be for New American Standard?
I don't know that. I'll give it to you. Yeah, equip you in every good thing.
Well, I guess what he's marking, I guess the lesson here is check different versions.
When I have 10 or 11, if I have 10, you have 11. I'm not too burned on that. I think the thing I want you to do as you go through this is start to get a sense of what's in view and how there's a distinction being made of one over the other. Same thing with new. When we talk about new, there are three or four under new that come out. The new covenant. New covenant in 8:13, 9:15, new covenant. 10:20 by new and living way or more excellent way. And 12:24, new covenant. So we all close up and leave. Y'all read it. Look at the summary, the little summary, item number two. And this is the book, if you like. The message of the book. In Christ, everything is better. You just go through what y'all marked. Better messenger, better apostle, better priest, better covenant, with better promises, better hope, better possession, better country, better life, better resurrection. Better tabernacle, better sacrifice, a better way, that is faith.
Everything is
better. And everything is better. And so that's the message
of this book. Christ is spirit, and he'll go on to develop. He develops that throughout the book. Okay, we'll pick up, Lord willing, at F, and go ahead and get lesson 3.